is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the UN Refugee Agency reports 1.6 million South Sudanese have fled to neighboring countries to escape famine, fighting, and drought, making South Sudan the world's fastest-growing refugee crisis.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, at least 33 Somali refugees are reported killed and about 35 wounded after their vessel was attacked in a port city in Yemen. And Somali pirates have ended their hijacking of an oil tanker and released its 8-man Sri Lankan crew.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, at least 33 Somali refugees are reported killed and about 35 wounded, most of them seriously, after their vessel was riddled with light weapons fire in a port city in Yemen. The wounded are among 80 Somalis who survived the attack in the rebel-held port of Hodeida. Women and children are among the dead. The International Organization for Migration says the circumstances surrounding the incident are not clear. The rebel-controlled news agency has accused the Saudi-led coalition of being responsible. It claims the refugees were attacked from the air by helicopters, but that's not been confirmed. It's also not clear on whether the Somalis were arriving or leaving Yemen. Despite the civil war, many people still travel from the Horn of Africa to Yemen, hoping to make their way to Saudi Arabia, where they might find jobs. The death toll in the incident could rise because of the severity of the wounds among many of the refugees.
Somali pirates have ended their hijacking of an oil tanker and released its 8-man Sri Lankan crew. The pirates, who claim to be disgruntled fishermen, released the ship and crew yesterday after a gunfight earlier in the day with Somali naval forces. Two people in the Somali town of Habo were wounded as naval forces traded fire with men trying to ferry supplies to the tanker. Officials said local elders negotiated the release of the Ares 13. The pirates were allowed to leave the vessel and return to shore. They were also reportedly granted immunity by the Puntland government. The Ares 13 was hijacked on Monday.
The UN Refugee Agency reports 1.6 million South Sudanese have fled to neighboring countries to escape famine, fighting, and drought, making South Sudan the world's fastest-growing refugee crisis. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency calls the rate of displacement from South Sudan alarming, placing an impossible burden on the region. This is particularly true of Uganda, which is hosting nearly half of all the refugees, some 800,000 people. UNHCR spokesman Babar Baloch says more than 2,800 people on average are fleeing into Uganda every day. He tells VOA most of the refugees, some 86%, are women and children.
They come in quite desperate situation, being affected by instability, fighting, and famine. Food security is an issue. They arrive into settlements into northern Uganda. All the structures that we have been trying to put in place with the government in Uganda are overstretched.
For example, Balash notes Bidibidi Camp, one of four refugee settlements in Uganda, currently shelters 272,000 refugees.
With low level of fundings and host communities and the host government not having enough resources, it is making it quite an impossible task to help these desperate refugees, and that's the reason we're trying to sound this alarm.
South Sudan's civil war, which erupted more than 3 years ago, has displaced more than 3.5 million people, both inside and outside the country. The United Nations reports 4.8 million people inside the country are going hungry, with 100,000 facing famine. Despite the bleak statistics, Baloch says South Sudan is not getting enough attention, nor is it getting enough resources. He says the UN has received only 8% 10% of the $782 million it needs for its humanitarian operations this year. He says the UNHCR's own appeal for Uganda is short by more than $250 million. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Kenya's president has ordered troops be sent to two counties in the Rift Valley where drought-related violence has erupted. The Associated Press reports President Kenyatta has authorized the immediate deployment of troops to Baringo and Laikipia counties. At least 21 people have been killed in fighting between herding in Baringo County since early February, 13 this week alone. In Laikipia County, a British farmer was killed this month by herders invading ranches looking for food and water for their livestock.
More than 14,000 migrants and refugees who sought asylum have been relocated from Greece and Italy to other European countries. The International Organization for Migration says efforts to relocate them began in October 2015. In other migrant news, the IOM says nearly 20,000 migrants and refugees have arrived in Europe by sea so far this year. Over 80% of them have gone to Italy and the rest to Spain and Greece. At least 525 migrants have died while trying to make the journey. Also, the UN agency reports a 27% increase in migrant deaths worldwide last year compared to 2015. More than 7,700 migrant deaths were recorded last in all regions, including the Mediterranean Sea, Europe, North Africa, the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and the Americas.
This week, a new water treatment plant in Uganda has begun supplying fresh water to 86,000 South Sudanese refugees. The facility is located in the Arua district. It was set up by the International Federation of the Red Cross, along with Red Cross chapters from Uganda, Sweden, Austria, and Germany. Matthew Cochran is a spokesman for the IFRC from Geneva. He spoke to VOA's William Eagle about the new water treatment facility.
The water treatment facility that's come online in the last few days is at the moment pumping about 400,000 litres out of the Nile, where it's filtering it, treating it, testing it for quality, and then trucking it to Rhino Camp, which is home to about 86,000 refugees. It's one of the main sources of water for the 86,000 people living there. It supplements a fair bit of work that's already being done in country by the Uganda Red Cross. Even before this facility came online, they were providing about 2.5 million litres of treated water, benefiting around 235,000 people every day.
I understand that the plant will provide or treat 1 million litres of potable water per day. Is that enough for current numbers, or are you also planning on further expansion?
When we started looking at the situation in Uganda, even a couple of weeks ago, the numbers that were being reported were significantly lower to the numbers we're looking at today. Every day there's hundreds, even thousands of people crossing the border. I think there's 780,000 refugees from South Sudan now in Uganda, and that's growing significantly on a daily basis. At the moment, the amount of water we're producing is significant for communities that we're focusing on. Obviously, the Red Cross isn't the only partner active in these camps. In terms of scaling up in the future, it's something we're looking at very closely, something that we're aware that we might need to do, and it's certainly something that we're talking with our partners to make sure that if we do need to scale up, that the resources are available or that other partners who are better placed can step in and bring in more resources and supplies.
The rainy season begins soon. What type of challenge does that pose for water supplies or for sanitation in the camps?
It's a difficult time of the year in parts of northern Uganda, I think at the best of times. We're very concerned about the impact it'll have on sanitation, which is already grossly inadequate. And to that end, we've actually started a project to significantly improve sanitation for thousands of people. We're concerned that it brings with it vector and waterborne diseases, so diseases like cholera, malaria. These are things that we know whenever there's a large movement of people, we know when access to clean water and basic sanitation is compromised, that these are the kind of risks that we can face. It's why we're moving so quickly and so urgently on it. It'll go a long way to helping people protect themselves from these kind of challenges, but it's something that we're very concerned about.
The Red Cross is also helping to build latrines. Can you tell us more about that?
We're focusing primarily on one site, a site called Ndepe, which only opened in late February, but it's swollen to well over 30,000 people from South Sudan now living there. There's huge challenges there around latrines. There's only 35 latrines accessible in that reception centre, which translates to a ratio of about one for every 343 people, which is grossly inadequate. By comparison, the standard that we seek to achieve in these kind of contexts is a latrine for every 20 people. It means that many people are unable to use the latrine, defecating in the open, which in turn increases the risk of disease spread. So teams from the Uganda Red Cross, with support from the British and from the International Federation, are looking to build a further 50 latrines to reduce some of the immediate pressure. Looking out into the medium term, though, well, not so medium term, there's an urgency there as well. We're looking to build about 4,000 latrines for people once they've moved out of the reception centres into the small land allocation that the government and UNHCR are giving to families coming from South Sudan.
Matthew Cochran is a spokesman for the International Federation of the Red Cross. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Bill Eagle.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Zimbabwe health officials are trying to contain several cholera outbreaks in the country. Reporter Kuzazi Zvinavashi reports from Harare.
Cholera is still fresh in the minds of Zimbabweans following outbreaks that have claimed lives in the past decades. Speaking at a press conference in the capital, Dr. Gerald Gwinji, the permanent secretary of the Ministry of Health, said there is the potential for current outbreaks to spread.
We called you here because we need to alert yourselves and the nation at large to a potential challenge that is brewing in the form of cholera in one, or let me say two, parts of our country.
Deputy Minister of Health Aldrin Musiwa gives the locations of current outbreaks in Zimbabwe. The areas with cholera cases are near the Mozambique border, an area recently hit by floods. That's making the situation more challenging for communities to access health facilities and clean water. With severe cases of cholera in Mozambique, Musiwa suggests the cases may be related.
The area where the cases have been reported is adjacent to the border, where there is an influx of people coming from Mozambique. There are cases of cholera that have been reported in Mozambique and in the adjacent Manica province of Mozambique.
Gwinji says one case of cholera is too many.
As we always say, for us, one case of cholera is an outbreak, and therefore it's all systems go once that happens.
With the help of the World Health Organization, the government is working on containing the outbreak. Musiwa explains.
The cases are being managed. Medicines and other supplies are being mobilized and moved to the affected flood communities.
Cholera is an infectious disease caused by bacteria. Symptoms include vomiting, diarrhea, contributing to intense dehydration, and even death at times. 2008 was a terrible year for cholera in Zimbabwe. About 4,000 people died from the disease. The government has urged all communities that were hit by floods to practice good personal hygiene to avoid cholera and other diseases. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
12 of the world's largest chocolate companies have pledged to take action to end the destruction of rainforests. Production has expanded sharply in recent decades, destroying hundreds of thousands of hectares of trees. The pledge came at a summit yesterday, hosted by the Prince of Wales, who campaigns to save the world's rainforests. VOA's Jody Kapua reports.
The companies signed a collective statement of intent to end deforestation in the chocolate supply chain. Prince Charles praised the agreement, calling it a hugely encouraging step. He says it's the right thing to do. The prince says deforestation threatens to undermine the very resilience of the cocoa sector itself, and with it, the livelihoods of the millions of smallholders who depend on it. Cacao and cocoa appear and sound similar, but here's the difference. Cacao is the purest form of chocolate you can eat. It's raw and undergoes little processing. Cocoa, on the other hand, is the roasted form of cacao that's usually sold as a powder. It's easier just to think chocolate. New research shows that as the love of chocolate has grown, forests in West Africa have shrunk. The environmental group Mighty Earth says deforestation has been happening on a much larger scale than previously thought. Legal and campaign director Etel Igwene says she hopes industry promises will be followed by action.
There's a tremendous amount that the industry can do. What it can do really depends on what it sets its mind to doing. It can plant cacao in degraded lands. It can increase productivity. But most of all, I think the important question that we all need to ask is, does the industry care enough to decide that it's going to set a clear goal and make a time-bound implementation plan to get there for zero deforestation and also for human rights?
Deforestation and labor rights abuses, she says, have the same root cause.
They come from a quest for ever cheaper chocolate. We need to think hard as a society and also as an industry. We need to reflect very hard about not only protecting forests, but also protecting human rights and doing it as a package deal. I believe that there's a huge amount that we could learn from the other industries where people have done something similar and it's working.
Those industries, palm oil and soy, have agreed to sustainable production. Igwene says the Brazil soy moratorium is one example. Known as Soy M, the moratorium took effect more than 10 years ago. Activists and researchers call it the first voluntary zero deforestation agreement implemented in the tropics. The environmental group Greenpeace says it guarantees market access only to soy that does not come from deforested land and is not produced by slave labor. Soy production also must not threaten the land of indigenous people. The soy moratorium was signed by the Brazilian Vegetable Oil Industry Association and the National Association of Cereal Exporters. They control over 90% of soybean production in Brazil. Igwene says Soy M is a success.
They've had an increase in productivity, an increase in profitability, and a dramatic decrease in deforestation over there.
Mighty Earth has created an interactive computer map of cacao production regions in Ghana and Ivory Coast. Its timeline shows the expansion of deforestation from 2000 to 2014. Igwene says the deforestation is taking place even in protected areas.
You see the deforestation year by year. So these little red dots bubble up, and you can see that the map gets redder and redder and redder. When you zoom in to the interactive map, that's when it gets really interesting. That's when you can begin to see the difference between the pace of deforestation in the regular forest versus the protected forest. So when you're in the interactive maps, as you get towards the end, you see that it gets redder and redder and redder in 2012, 13, and 14.
She says just about everyone loves chocolate, but many do not know what she calls the dark, bitter truth behind it. The summit hosted by Prince Charles was also attended by delegations from Ghana, Ivory Coast, the Netherlands, Germany, France, and Britain, as well as the World Bank and the International Finance Corporation. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In a highly unusual move, Moroccan King Mohammed VI yesterday removed Prime Minister Abdelilah Benkirane, the head of the Islamist Justice and Development Party that won last year's parliamentary elections. The royal palace said Benkirane struggled to form a coalition with rival parties over the past 5 months. To learn about the rival parties and why they refused to cooperate in forming a new government, VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with Mohammed Cherkawi, professor of conflict resolution at George Mason University.
There are three main reasons. First, there has been a five-month political impasse and salient infighting between Mr. Benkirane and two well-known advisors to the king over the inclusion of a leftist party known as the Socialist Union of Popular Forces, led by Driss Lashgar, in the would-be coalition government that has never come to existence besides another three small parties. So we are talking about a forced coalition government coming from the royal entourage. Second, the personal animosity between Ben Kiran and these two advisors. The third and most important factor is the growing charismatic popularity of Ben Kiran as a populist Islamist leader who was the driving force behind the electoral victory of his party last October 7th. So it appears that the king's entourage has strategized to push him away from the political spotlight after serving a few years after the earthquake of the so-called Arab Spring and those demonstrations that, you know, were very frequent in many Moroccan cities in the spring of 2011.
Who are the rival powers and why they are refusing to cooperate with the prime minister?
Apparently, the main rival is a modernist and royalist party known as Party of Authenticity and Modernity, which was formed by King's advisor Fuad al-Himma in 2008. And this party came second in the last elections. It didn't fulfill the expectations of its backers among the advisors to the king. Another political figure is also relevant here, Aziz Akhnouch. He is a billionaire businessman who became leader of the so-called Assembly of the Independents that was formed similarly in 1972 by Reda Gdira, then advisor to the late King Hassan II. So the political battle has been between these two forces. One Islamist that pushes for the religiosity of society and dominant institutions, and opposite that we have the secular movement that has opted for a modernist and Western trajectory of Morocco. So the rejection of Ben Kiran now showcases the irony of two parallel forces. One, politics of legitimacy as outlined in the new constitution of 2011, and the other one, the politics of personal vendetta and the hierarchy of power. It seems that the latter has won over the former, and with one stone, the strategy of the king's advisors has apparently hit two birds. One, let's marginalize Ben Kiran, who happens to be charismatic Islamist leader, and two, let's implode his party into two factions. And ironically, we will see now one camp can be, you know, labeled as royalists, and the other camp could be super royalists.
Would another member of the Party for Justice and Development be able to form such a coalition?
I think what is hoped for now by the palace as a post-Ben Kiran scenario is to invite one of the other leading figures. And it seems that, as Ben Kiran himself stated, that the party will respond positively to the call of the king.
Mohamed Cherkawi is professor of conflict resolution at George Mason University. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world.
You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.